It's the Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Miss Natalie Walters, coming to us from New York, of course, but also The Motley Fool. She's a tech reporter for The Motley Fool. And we've also got our friend and fellow podcast launcher host, George Grombacher. George, how are you, buddy?
I am doing great. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. Natalie, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, just to kick things off, you know, today is May the 4th. We're recording on Friday, May the 4th. And I don't know if you all are aware, but there's a new Star Wars movie coming out I don't know if it's this week, but this is a pretty significant day. So there's a new Han Solo movie out. So
okay,
that's awesome.
Now, a couple of times on the show, you've referenced Star Trek. So
yeah.
is it possible for Star Trek people to also like Star Wars?
Well, I think it is possible. Number one, I'm a consultant, so I have to be agnostic.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I think I like Star Wars. You know, I grew up in the 70s. I'm probably a little bit older than everyone on this podcast, for the most part. And I think I grew up in the 70s, and I remember going to the movie theater to see the original Star Wars. Okay. And I was really moved.
Oh, yeah.
But I also like Star Trek.
Natalie, so, do you have a vote one way or another?
I don't. Honestly, I'm more focused on the Avengers movie that came out last week because I keep hearing about it. And I meant to go see it because I'm one of those people on the movie pass game, so I can, you know, see 30 movies a month, and I only pay $10 a month, which is awesome.
Nice.
And that
wow.
is an ad for movie pass. But but I've been meaning to see that. I don't know if you guys have heard amazing things about that like I have, but I've heard it's incredible.
It's possible that the three of us are the only people in the world that have yet to see it.
Well, I tell you, all those Marvel and DC comic movies, those superhero movies, have done real well, and obviously people are attracted. You know, we had Wonder Woman. I think last year was Wonder Woman came out last year.
That was really good.
And yeah, a tremendous movie, great special effects, but good acting, and they continue to do well. So I think we'll have to check it out. Maybe we'll have to add a movie review to the show. I don't know where we're going to fit that in, but. You know, it's great. So happy May the 4th, and then also happy Cinco de Mayo to you all. I hope you all are going to have some good times, no matter where you are on Saturday, enjoying the holiday.
Well, here in the Southwest, we most certainly pay attention. So,
well, that's great. So let's kick things off. So, George, I want to start with you. You're a fellow podcast hoster. You've got your own podcast called The Money Savage, which you can find on Podbean, iTunes, and Twitcher, I believe.
Google Play and Stitcher, yeah.
I'm sorry. Well, thank you so much for clarifying that. I'm sure there's going to be some people who are going to be upset. But so what was top of mind? I know you released a couple of podcasts. What did you talk about this week with your guests?
Yeah, three shows this week. We talked kids and money. So how do you talk to kids about money? And I think that's, number one, a really, really important thing because parents that don't necessarily have all the financial success in the world don't want their kids to have the same issues. So that was pretty good. We talked about getting out of debt on a second episode, and then we talked a little bit about understanding ERISA as well. But what I can tell you is what was top of mind is that you don't always want to believe everything you read, and that you also don't want to believe everything that you think. I think it's always important to go back and reevaluate, because depending on what statistic you hear, nobody has any money saved at all. But then I just heard one yesterday that said that one out of six millennials has over $100,000 saved up. So maybe that's hope for the future.
Yeah, I think it's certainly you know, it sounded like you covered some really good ground, and people should you know, check those out if they're inclined to do so and pick up some additional snippets that they may not appear on our podcast here. Lots of good stuff, and I agree. I think people need to kind of reevaluate from time to time, whether it's their portfolio, whether how much they're saving, what their game plan is. You know, certainly that I think that's lost upon a lot of folks, even people who are in the know, quote unquote, in the know. So good work by you, and I'm excited. And you know, I see the roster of guests continues to expand and do real well. So continue with that effort.
Yes, sir. I sure will.
So Natalie, we're going to turn our attention to tech, and I know there are a couple of big stories this week that you covered, being Apple and Snapchat as two of them. But why don't you kind of take us through what's top of mind for you and in the world of technology?
Yeah, it was a huge week for tech because of the earnings season. I mean, it was hard to even sort of pick out the biggest stories because there were so many. But the biggest things we had going on were Apple earnings, which did great. And there's always negative press leading up to Apple earnings. I think people kind of like the drama, and then they always turn out to be fine. And especially their iPhone shipments, people kept saying, you know, their suppliers are guiding for weak revenue next quarter, so obviously they're not selling many iPhones, and it's going to be a disaster. When it turns out, you know, it was fine, and their iPhone X was the most popular phone this quarter, which nobody was expecting. And then Snap had an opposite story. They did really poorly on their earnings, which I don't think was a huge surprise because they just released a redesign in February that their users disliked, the publishers disliked, and, you know, that kind of scared the advertisers away. So nobody was expecting it to be good, and it wasn't good. And they were kind of trying to calm investors on the earnings call. So those were two big stories, kind of a good and bad. But there's also some other smaller stories, like Facebook held a conference and announced they're going to start a dating app. Mm. So, you know, that's not good news for Tinder or for Match. And then the WhatsApp co-founder left, and people are saying it's because he wasn't comfortable with Facebook's use of its data and sort of pushing the limits on data privacy. So, yeah, there was a lot of big stories this week, and it was an interesting week to be a tech reporter.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously data remains a key issue. I think that's going to be something that we're going to continue to hear and see about. I know in the financial press, you know, that continues to get a lot of play, especially when you talk about the Equifax data breach that occurred, I think, 6 to 8 months ago. And, you know, we continue to talk about how do we protect shareholders, participants, just general data. And in terms of Apple, I think what's interesting there is they continue to evolve. I think, you know, that's an example of a company. And you know, George will always give the, you know, we are not endorsing any particular company or service, so I'll step in and do that here. But they're an example where they have continued to adapt, and I think surprising many. You know, they started off as a PC manufacturer, made their way into devices, and really have continued to do that. And, you know, they're moving into the content world that we talked about last week with Todd Mason. So really interesting. And then in the Snap piece, George, I mean, we don't really use Snapchat a lot in our field in terms of reaching people. Maybe we should. But interesting to see kind of the pushback on how important design is to an app.
Yeah.
I know we go through that with websites and things that we evaluate as consultants for many of the plan providers in our space.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Snap just did a poor job with it. I mean, Instagram goes through updates all the time, but they're updates that people like that make it a better service. I mean, just this morning they started testing out a new feature that lets you buy, you know, a purse on the app. You can now, you know, insert payment information and you'll be able to buy stuff there. I mean, that's great. You don't have to go to a second website to buy something. But for Snap, when they came out with that redesign, all the users said, this is terrible. It's harder to use. I can't find my friends' stories. And they asked Snap to change it. And Snap kind of had a prideful response. They were kind of like, oh, well, it's going to be better. You just haven't gotten used to it. You'll see that our changes are better, and you just, you know, kind of don't know what you guys are talking about yet. So it's kind of interesting to see that backfire, and I think it comes back to you always need to listen to your customers and your users. At the end of the day, they're the most important thing, and, you know, I think that's a great thing about Amazon is that they always put the customer first, and that's why they have that amazing Prime program. I mean, who can complain about paying $119 a year for all the amazing benefits, like the music and the videos and the free 2-day shipping. So I think it comes back to Snap didn't listen to their users or customers. And going forward, if they want to get back on track, they need to start listening to them. And they've started to do that in the past few weeks. They said they're going to kind of backtrack on some of those redesign issues and kind of go back to the old design in some ways. But they're still keeping a few changes. So we'll see if that helps them next quarter.
George, you know, customers are important, especially in our business.
Yes.
I mean, obviously they pay the bill. They pay for services, but yeah, that was kind of an open-ended bad question. Sorry. I'm still working on my co-host. That's my co-host training coming through. But I mean, you know, George, your perception as someone who, you know, you're working with plan sponsors, employers who were evaluating not only their retirement programs, but their retirement plan providers. And retirement plan providers are, like Snap, like Apple, going through enhancements. You've got to listen to your customers. You've got to make sure that you're in sync, in alignment with what their values are and what they are telling you they want.
I always like to say that I'd rather be useful than brilliant. And it sounds a little bit like in this example, Snap was trying to be a little bit more brilliant as opposed to useful. So, and like Natalie has been saying, the customer is, you do need to listen to your customers. I appreciate when a visionary leader or CEO or whatever says, no, this is the way that we're going and this is the way it's going to work out. And maybe that's long term what will happen. But what we know for sure is that all of these companies are innovating like crazy. So I think that they need to be listening and paying attention to make sure that they're actually practical and people feel ease and comfort using them. So,
yeah, let me throw that out. Let me just throw something out there to you guys. I mean, can you over innovate? I mean, we need to innovate. And George, you make the and Natalie made the case that these companies are constantly evolving. And I think George, you're the one who said that maybe you're trying to be too, you know, some companies are being too cute or, you know, too cerebral. Can you out innovate your customers and in a way alienate them by changing it so much that it's hard to keep up?
I think that that's very possible. And Natalie, I don't mean to necessarily interrupt here, but one thing for sure is that you have people like Warren Buffett who look at really the fundamentals of things, right? And I think that you had a piece on Berkshire Hathaway this week, didn't you, Natalie? Or something about that with Apple?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's very interesting. Apple hit a new all-time high this morning because of this new information that came out from Berkshire Hathaway that they've added 75 million Apple shares in the past 3 months. So that's pretty amazing because it already had about 160. So now it has a total of 240 million shares in Apple. And that's really amazing because Warren Buffett was always known for not really trusting tech companies or tech stocks because he said he didn't grow up with it. He didn't really feel comfortable with it. But Apple has been a totally different story. He only started buying up shares of Apple in 2016. And so now he has 240 million. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And it shows the confidence he has in it. So that sort of shot Apple shares up this morning. And I thought it was interesting, some of his comments. He was saying that, you know, obsessing over iPhone sales in the near term, you know, how many did they sell over these 3 months? Oh, well, then it's doing bad, or it's going to do great. You know, obsessing over things like that is not really the point, and that's not really something you should be looking at when you're investing long term. And I just thought that was a good point. So even though the iPhone X did end up doing fine this quarter, you know, it's sort of interesting how much coverage iPhone sales get from, you know, month to month. And we should probably be focusing more on the fundamentals and long-term growth potential there.
Amen. Amen to that. It's just in terms of, I think you're preaching to the choir and all of the listeners here, Natalie. One thing I wanted to bring up, we have about a little less than a minute left in this segment. One thing that was really big in our space, George and Natalie, was the purchase or the merger of Edelman and Financial Engines. So Financial Engines, a registered investment advisory, like a robo-advisor in a way, managed account type of program, servicing about 11 million 401k participants, kind of merged with Edelman Financial Services. I think that was a big deal. It was about $3 billion. And I think it's interesting for one reason and one reason only, in that you had this move to technology, which Financial Engines has been around for a long time. It's been founded and does the follows the algorithm of Nobel laureate Bill Sharp. But Rick Edelman is always talking about on his program about indexing and the importance of working with an advisor. So it kind of blends the advisor community with the robo community. I thought that was interesting.
No doubt about it, and I think that that's going to be the answer long term. It's never, rarely is it ever yes or no, a binary choice. It's probably going to be a combination of those two, so I think that Mr. Edelman's probably going in the right direction.
Great. Well, Natalie, appreciate you joining today, and wish you the very best for a great weekend, and we're looking forward to having you back next week with some more, I don't know, tech tips. We need to come up with a really good name for this segment, maybe like tech tips or, you know, but we certainly appreciate you coming on, and great job as always.
Have a good weekend, Natalie.
Hey, thanks, guys. Have a great weekend, guys.
Bye.
All right,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. That was Natalie Walters, tech reporter for The Motley Fool, and now joining us on the line is Jacob Passy, personal finance writer at MarketWatch. Hey, Jacob.
Hey there.
So, Jacob, I know that you guys were looking into and reading about how scientists at Harvard say that there are a handful of things that could actually prolong our lives for a decade. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of somewhat the usual suspects, but they basically came up with a list of five things that you can do to extend your life by about a decade. So first one, eat a healthy diet. Second one was exercise 30 minutes or more a day. The third one was to maintain a healthy weight, and specifically they said you should aim for a body mass index between 18.5 and 24.9. And there are, you know, different body mass index calculators you can find online if you don't know yours. The fourth thing they suggested was not to drink too much alcohol. So they said no more than a five-ounce glass of wine per day for women and 2 5-ounce glasses for men. And then the last one was never to smoke. So those were the five things. It was based on an analysis of over 3 decades worth of data from more than 78,000 women and 27 years of data from more than 44,000 men. So quite a large sample. And yeah, I mean, the points they made are, you know, kind of obvious. It's in line with a lot of stuff that we hear. But I think it was just interesting because it really showed how, you know, just how markedly longer your life can be if you follow those healthy tips.
So, Jeff, if you're going to live for an additional 10 years longer than you expected, that means you need to be saving more money, sir.
Yeah, I mean, that was initially where I was going, so I don't know if you all had read. I mean, that just, you know, we talk about it on the show. I think we talk about it as an industry. One of the big topics that has come up over the last year plus is the cost of healthcare in retirement, Jacob. It's estimated, I think Fidelity or someone had a study that estimated it was about $280,000 in today's dollars for a couple. In terms of, and you know, yes, we are going to be living longer. There is no doubt about it that, you know, barring any unforeseen cataclysmic event or an unfortunate disease that people get, and that's a very unfortunate part of our life, people will be living longer. And I think that's really why people really need to be saving and planning and thinking about a lot of these things, balancing the costs and the things today versus, you know, what are they going to have tomorrow and thinking about these things. So, you know, I mean, it's a big issue.
It is. And that's those are simple things that those Harvard scientists were talking about, but what you're supposed to be doing, what you're supposed to be eating, exercising, that's always a moving target, and it seems like there's always something new coming out. So to a degree, it is refreshing.
Yeah,
that go ahead.
I think the one other thing I would add is, you know, not only will you live longer, but I mean, functionally what all those tips are doing is helping you, you know, avoid the chronic health problems that these that the opposite bad habits can cause. And I think that's, you know, that's in large part, you know, why people start seeing health costs creep up as they get older, is because, you know, if you don't eat healthy or exercise regularly, you know, that just compounds with all the chronic heart conditions and things like that can cause. So being healthy is not only, you know, prudent to if you just want to live a long life, but it's also prudent to keep your health care expenses in check.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's, and I would just say it's really hard to get back into a workout program. I've been doing that over the last six months. You know, I'm in my 40s. I'm going to be 46 next week. Let's not broadcast that outside of this little group. And, you know, I think it's harder to kind of change your frame of mind the older you get. So I think, you know, obviously starting earlier matters. And then for us older folks or people in their middle age, it's, you know, it's harder to work yourself back in. So
put down that third glass of red wine and do some push-ups, listeners.
Yes.
All right. So a lot of folks want to help their kids out with money, but that could potentially be a bad decision.
Yeah. So Allie actually was the one who wrote this story, and so she was looking at a report from Anna Manzoni, who's a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University, and what she found was, you know, it's not, you know, the act of financially supporting a child alone isn't inherently bad. It's how you go about it that can be bad. So her research found that when parents just give their money, give their children money, I should say, directly, you know, just cut them a check or something like that, those children will generally go on to have greater professional success. But when they do other, you know, things to help their children out financially, one example being, you know, letting their kids live at home for free, it's actually the opposite. It'll make it harder for them to move up in their careers. So her research found that young adults who receive more than $15,000 a year from their parents ranked higher on a scale of occupational status that the researchers created that was measured by income than those who didn't receive monetary support. But children who lived at home ranked lower than those who weren't receiving support. So parents, I think, you know, especially given the high cost of college education these days and, you know, the lower wages that a lot of folks see coming out of college, you know, unpaid internships, that sort of thing, you know, it's easy for a parent to want to support their child, but you know, living at home may not actually may not really be in their best interest, according to research.
So no free room and board.
No. But you know, it's a tough situation because inequality is a major problem, and so folks, you know, who, you know, not all parents obviously have access to financial resources to be able to cut their kids a check to help offset living costs and things like that. So at the very least, it's just something to keep in mind and to try to work against if you are in that situation where your child has to move back home because they don't really have a better option.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's this, you know, it's really hard. I remember when I was kind of breaking in to business after school. I think it's hard to find that first job, and it, you know, it's a challenge. And you sometimes you need a few breaks. So I think it is kind of a balancing act. But you don't want to create a society, you know, like a level of dependency, because there have been studies
exactly.
that said that if you do help your child out, and I think you're alluding to this in your comments, Jacob, then, you know, you could actually damage your ability to retire on time or to take care of your financial, have pure financial wellness. So, you know, I think it is a balancing act. I mean, it's never all one thing or the other, as we talked about in our last segment. So, it's a big challenge for people who are just entering the workforce and trying to find a job or jobs to support themselves and build a level of experience.
Yeah. Definitely. And I mean, there are millennials who like live at home to, you know, save to build up a down payment or something like that. And that's definitely, you know, that can have its own benefits. But another thing that researchers pointed out was, you know, choosing to live at home, if that's your only option, you're narrowing, you know, the types of jobs that you'll be able to apply to. You know, if your parents live, you know, if they don't live in a major city or something like that, you know, you're not necessarily going to have access to the same sort of resources in that sense. So it's definitely a balancing act.
It is that. Well, Jacob, we got a couple more minutes. Tell us a little bit about the merger between T-Mobile and Sprint.
Yes, so this was announced over the weekend, and you know, it had been rumored for a while now. Both of them have had their struggles over the years, are definitely, you know, smaller carriers when compared to AT&T and Verizon, and so they're planning to merge, you know, to, in their mind's eye, to compete more effectively with those larger players. It's going to be a big deal, literally and figuratively, but for consumers, it may not really pan out the way that they might hope. There are fears among analysts that that a merger between the two will mean that Sprint, being the lower cost carrier, will go away, and so there might not be the low cost option, you know, alternative that Sprint used to represent, at least among the major carriers, and that could reduce competition, which reduces the incentive to, you know, offer more deals and things like that. Also, what a lot of people may not realize is even if you don't have T-Mobile or Sprint, the deal could affect you directly because a lot of, you know, the smaller regional carriers, you know, the carriers such as Metro PCS, Boost Mobile, Cricket Wireless, they are what is known as a mobile virtual network operator. And so that's basically like a fancy phrase that just means that, you know, these companies basically use the wireless networks. They basically rent the wireless networks from larger carriers and then pass those savings on to consumers. And that's why, you know, Metro PCS is cheaper. But because T-Mobile and Sprint are merging, a lot of these other carriers who use those networks will be affected. So they could be affected in a positive way because, you know, there will be a wider coverage area now because of the two companies joining forces. But also, you know, higher costs and things like that might trickle down as well.
Well, that is definitely something to keep an eye on. So,
yes.
Well, Jacob Passy from MarketWatch, thank you, sir. Have a great weekend. And until next week.
And you too.
And may the fourth be with you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jacob. Welcome back, everybody. That was Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter from MarketWatch. And now joining us are two of our favorite contributors, if not our most favorite, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group. Gentlemen, how are
you? Good. Great. Thanks. That was a really generous lead-in.
Thank you.
Normally, we have to settle for being legal eagles.
Okay, you're right. Yes.
Wow.
That's true.
Okay. I'm going to up him next week when I do the intro.
So, David, you got plans for Cinco de Mayo, sir?
Plans for Cinco de Mayo have absolutely nothing to do with Cinco de Mayo. One word, baseball. I leave it at that.
Kevin?
Oh, okay. Now that I'm realizing that it's Cuatro de Mayo today, I might take advantage of Cinco de Mayo tomorrow.
Okay, wow.
But well, you know, it's today is May the 4th, so Star Wars, there's a new Star Wars movie coming out. You know, you guys know.
Oh, yes. I know May the 4th. I was at my daughter's school this morning, and I saw people dressed up for May the 4th.
Hey.
Well, it's a cautionary tale on a big holiday like St. Paddy's or Cinco de Mayo, whatever. There's an opportunity to go missing, and perhaps you guys can shed some light on that, but from a different perspective.
So you might be right. That might be a new angle, that the main cause of missing participants might be St. Patrick's Day and Cinco de Mayo.
New Year's Eve.
I hadn't thought of that.
You got to expand your horizons a little bit, gentlemen.
I wonder how that would go over in a DOL investigation. I don't really want to find out, though, because truthfully, I would understand if they might not really agree with our argument on that one.
In all seriousness, this is obviously an important topic, so if you guys could enlighten us, please.
Sure. Missing participants. It has been the bane of many folks' existence over recent years because whether it's because you're terminating a plan and there's nice Department of Labor guidance from 2014 on this, to whether you have missing people who are turning age 70 and a half, and the IRS gave us some nice guidance on this in the past year, or you just have people who don't like to cash checks. And there's good and bad reasons. Sometimes it's people you can't find them. Sometimes it's people don't want to be found for a variety of reasons.
I mean, David, I was at a great event where Tom Reeder, the head of the PBGC, was talking about the problems PBGC is having finding people, and they've commented that they've found people on the witness protection program and people who are hiding from creditors. So I think you're making a pretty good observation here.
Well, thank you. And but the challenge is that everybody is facing, aside from trying to do the right thing, virtually all plan sponsors and their service providers are really trying, like record keepers and such, to really do right and find people. They know this money doesn't belong to them. But as part of this, what we're running into these days is the Department of Labor, a couple years ago, was investigating a plan and came upon a plan that reportedly had a very large sum of uncashed checks and missing participants, which led them to start a program and that's now gone nationwide, where they ask, often in defined benefit, but it's also defined contribution sometimes, where in the world are your missing participants? And this is where the experience turns complex, because the Department of Labor, they're obviously trying to look out for participants, and we can all agree to disagree sometimes. But there's no real hard and fast standards that are out there for people who are for active plans. And the Department of Labor is really pushing hard, and it leads to some agreements, some disagreements. But the question, I think, is how do we move this forward? Because for right now, some of these investigations have become very, very costly and a lot of work from a lot of people who genuinely just want to do the right thing by their clients. Kevin, you probably have a lot more to add.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of everyone's in agreement that the mission of these investigations is really a noble mission. The idea out there that you've got people who are approaching retirement age or who are in retirement, who are owed a benefit and who aren't getting that benefit, it's a very sympathetic situation. I think the real challenge here is that plan sponsors, record keepers, and kind of industry in general, it's kind of at a loss, because kind of ERISA Section 404 says you're going to kind of, you run the plan in accordance with the terms of the plan document, and you only incur reasonable plan expenses. So when you're looking for these participants, you've got to keep those two balancing factors in mind. The area where we've gotten kind of DOL guidance, it's in the area of plans, defined contribution plans, that are being terminated. So when I think about that, a terminated defined contribution plan, going back to the Cinco de Mayo and St. Patrick's Day analogy, kind of when your plan's terminating, it's kind of like last call. So they kind of list out certain things that you need to do if you're ringing that bell and saying, hey, participants, this is your last chance to get your checks. And what's kind of unfortunate for plan fiduciaries is that they're being investigated in this environment where they know it's required at last call for some of these plans, but it's kind of unclear exactly what the department wants them to do while the plan's ongoing. And in some of these investigations, it seems like they're asking for more from an ongoing plan than they'd require from a terminating plan.
I completely agree with you, Kevin. And I think what happens is because these aren't terminating plans, we run into so many challenges as we go forward right now. Because we've talked about people not wanting to be found, but what are you supposed to do? The Department of Labor has, in some cases, asked for social media searches or former employee searches. And the problem is there's no clear defined standards at this point. And I think there's some hesitancy to agree to some of these standards even. And I think what we're facing at this point is I think everybody would benefit from some certainty as to what's going on, what the rules of the game are, and so that everybody can work together. There's a lot of precedent in the past where the Department of Labor has come together and put out guidance like on directed trustees and other types of areas about what their duties are. And this could be another great area where, just like the hardship guidance last year about how you can approve hardships, where the plan sponsors, the plan fiduciaries, and the service providers and the regulators could all work together and come up with something that's a good, solid answer that's actually workable. That's my two cents on it at this point.
Yeah, so if I was going to say two really positive things about this, the first positive is that more participants are getting benefits as a result of these investigations and would have gotten their benefits otherwise. The second positive is that it seems like DOL should have enough information now that it should know what works and what doesn't work. And hopefully it can issue guidance in the near future, kind of setting out what best practices are for plans so that they can satisfy their forward-looking duty of prudence.
Excellent.
I think,
Please.
I was going to say that. Look, I think participants need to keep their addresses updated at the record keeper. I mean, they share some responsibility. They want to keep track of 401k balances. I mean, I know if I don't keep my all my benefits updated, if I either I switch employers or, you know, even keeping track of my login credentials can be challenging. I think it's important in today's environment that, you know, obviously employers need to do their part, but people need to do their part. And this is not really a DOL issue, but people need to do their part to make sure that they know where their benefits are and what they have. Because you don't want to be at coming close to retirement and then wondering, okay, did I have a 401k at this place or what happened to my assets here? I think, that's part of the prudence of being a person who's got benefits, who's got a retirement program. They should have some, and again, this is not a legal issue, but they should have some burden to bear in terms of keeping that information up to date so they know what they have.
I mean, you're raising a great policy argument. I mean, just if I know somebody owes me money, I try not to hide. I've got incentives to let them know where I am.
Well, and what I was going to say is as we look towards the future here, we you're right. There's no obligation for people to do this. A lot of plans try to put in language and remind people they need to do this. And you hit on something that I think maybe is a good topic for one of our future weeks: data privacy and protection, and protecting your information. And part of it is knowing where your money is. So there's a role for everybody to play in this process. It's just about getting everybody to a common agreement of something that's practical, workable, and really in the best interest of everybody involved.
David, are you seriously proposing we do something like updating plan addresses in an era of GDPR?
I refuse to comment on that because I don't want to violate GDPR.
Nobody knows what that means, so.
It's a European data privacy regulation coming online soon.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there's lots of editing to be done on this week. Got it.
Sorry, guys.
So what I know for sure is I'm going to be keeping a close eye on social media this weekend to make sure that both you guys are doing exactly what you said you were going to be doing. So thanks so much, guys.
Thanks
for having us on.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back. That was a great segment from David Levine and Kevin Walsh talking about missing participants. Some more to come on that. And now, George, we're joined by two great guests from the Defined Contribution Real Estate Council. We've got co-presidents Jennifer Perkins and Alan Swearingen. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Great, Jeff. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And I think before we kind of dive into real estate, Jennifer, can you talk a little bit about the Defined Contribution Real Estate Council? I know you all are celebrating your fifth anniversary, but many in the audience may not know exactly the DCREC and what its mission and values are. So could you start there?
Absolutely. Yes. The Defined Contribution Real Estate Council, dubbed DCREC, is a member-led nonprofit organization. We've got about 28 members, primarily real estate investment managers, and a handful of service providers, meaning valuation consultants, law firms, trust companies, that help provide real estate solutions for defined contribution plans. And our mission statement... Because we're a group of competitors, we have come together with a mission statement to promote the inclusion of investments in direct commercial real estate and real estate securities within defined contribution plans, with a focus to improve participant outcomes by furthering education about, advocacy for, and best practices of including real estate.
Thank you, Jennifer. So, Alan, obviously real estate is something that's used in a lot of different portfolios. So we currently use them, not we, but they are currently used, real estate's used in defined benefit plans, pension plans, and they're used in endowment and foundations. So why haven't they been used, or have they been used, I guess, in defined contribution? What's the update on those, on like 401k, governmental 457, 403b plans? Is there an update on the status of using these types of instruments in those types of plans?
Well, there is, Jeff, but let me start with the first part of the question. Maybe I'll start with the second part of the question, which is the update is the use of real estate specifically, and to some degree, all alternative assets is actually woefully underutilized in the self-directed defined contribution world, and you know, and that includes whether it's corporate 401k plans or even our own, you know, portable retirement plans, IRA accounts. And it basically is because the benefits menu when you go online and whatever your service provider is for you to make your own investment selections, historically there haven't been direct real estate, and there's been very limited real estate securities investment offerings, and the whole mission of the DCREC is to expand that and to enhance that and trying to educate folks. And what's interesting about it is, as you said, the defined benefit world, the big pension plans, whether they be corporate plans or public plans or even the foundations and endowments, they've been actively using direct real estate and listed real estate for 20, 25 years. You know, the ERISA laws changed 20, 30 years ago, and it forced fiduciaries to start embracing alternative assets and really thinking about investing on the efficient frontier. And so these top-down led plans have been using real estate for a long, long time. But the self-directed plans, we're not the menu selection there that we'd like it to be. And that's really what the whole mission and purpose is of the DCREC. And if I could go on one more point here, Callan,
sure,
did an exhaustive study a few years ago about the return performance of all of the assets in the defined contribution space versus the returns over the last 10 years for the defined benefit space. And they showed that all the money that we're making our own investment decisions about with our own menu choices, we're lagging the DB plans by almost 180 basis points. So when we make our own investment decisions, we don't do as good a job as the top-down plans. And the reason is, they identified was two things, is that individual investors often pay higher fees, and you're seeing a lot of pressure on fees. But also, individual investors don't embrace alternative investments, and that's really because they don't have those as a menu choice. So the fastest growing, largest wealth in our country today is our own self-directed IRAs and 401ks, and yet we're lagging investment returns significantly from the DB plans, which is, you know, underpinning the mission of DCREC.
Got it.
And, Jeff, if I can just add
sure.
a couple of stats, you know, that we've done a lot of work within Defined Contribution Real Estate Council just to try to peel the onion, especially on the private equity real estate that's being used in, we've narrowed in on the defined contribution plans, and we came up with numbers that, as Alan alluded to, were a little bit light, and they're a little bit hard to really determine, because we have seen a lot of, where we have seen inclusion of private equity real estate strategies is really within custom target date solutions, such that they act and feel a lot like the defined benefit plans that Alan was just describing, versus, you know, participant-directed plans. So if looking at our study, we were able to identify approximately $25 billion in AUM for private equity real estate and defined contribution plans, which is representative of about 100 defined contribution plans that are using strategies that include private real estate. And, you know, we went a step further and tried to figure out how many industry people are supporting this, and identified approximately 20 consultants, 14 record keepers, and 10 custodians that are all supporting private equity real estate in, again, a multi-asset strategy that's professionally managed from a top-down approach.
Got it. That seems like not very many.
It's not. No, it's a point. Yeah. It's
It's usually the larger end of the retirement plan spectrum. So it's I think it's the mega plan.
If I can ask a question,
tend to do.
It's interesting timing, Jennifer. I have a new client, and we're just putting a principal 401k plan in place. And part of the fund offering that we were discussing was that there were a couple of real estate options, but I have to imagine it's different from what you guys are talking about. How does what you're talking about actually work? And how will down the road, if you're successful, how will me as a plan participant recognize that?
Well, a lot of us in the industry are really focused in on becoming a sleeve of a multi-asset strategy because we think from a strategic standpoint, that's really how private equity real estate is best used. From a professional manager, recognizing that the reason that they're incorporating it into a strategy is to help lower that volatility, increase the income return, and you know, make the experience for their defined contribution participants less volatile, such that there's, you know, maybe a little bit of help with the abandonment risk for the plan, just to try to keep those plan members involved. So, you know, we really see it as offering our strategies to be included as an investment sleeve within these multi-asset strategies.
Got it.
Yeah,
another
point I'd make is,
you know, there's been a big investment by a lot of firms to kind of improve their transparency, and one of the big issues with private direct real estate used to be, but I think we've made major inroads in that, is used to be the regular the frequency, I guess, of valuations. You know, most pension plans think about their private equity investments and you know, historically used to try to ask managers to mark them to market on a quarterly basis. You know, that doesn't really work for people's own 401k plans, but there's a number of the members of the DCREC, and in fact, the NCREIF, which is the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries, which is kind of the performance reporting organization of the institutional real estate world, they actually formed just a little over a year ago a daily valued index. And so, Jennifer, I think we tracked 9 sponsors out there that have either a sleeve or in the aggregate are actually marking their real estate portfolios on a daily basis. And so investors have a lot more transparency and visibility into the valuation. I think the other challenge that we continue to face when you think about private real estate is the liquidity, you know, because for the most part, we're investing in high quality, you know, institutional properties that don't trade on a daily basis. You know, they trade,
right.
I often tell people it takes 90 to 120 days to thoughtfully buy a $100 million building, it, and it equally takes about 90 to 120 days to thoughtfully sell one. And that you can't move your real estate allocations on a daily basis if you're investing in those sort of assets. But that's where part of the solution, we believe long-term, will be things like target date funds. But the reality is there's no real requirement in the laws under ERISA to have daily liquidity. And a lot of folks in their own IRA rollover investments are investing in illiquid solutions when they can get access to them. And so we've made a long way in valuation. We probably have more to go on liquidity, but I think most of it is about education, which, again, is the whole mission of the Defined Contribution Real Estate Council.
Yeah, and I'll add on to Alan's comment specific to the daily valuation. One of the other things that DCREC is very focused on is to try to break down these barriers that have historically prevented inclusion of particularly private equity real estate and defined contribution plans. And we're working on best practices and publishing best practices for the marketplace to really help identify how to achieve, from an operational standpoint, ways such that private equity can fit into a defined contribution plan. And one of those best practice pieces that we have already published is on it's specific to daily valuation. So best practices around the daily valuation process, such that it's instructive to plan sponsors as well as consultants who aren't as familiar with how that daily valuation process is achieved. And so we've tried to produce pieces like that that are educational and help knock down these historical barriers to allow us to better participate in the defined contribution construct.
Excellent stuff.
There's been some great work that has been done over the last 5 years. Obviously, some more to do, but it's also, it's a two-way street, right? So people, the DCRC needs to do its job in terms of educating, but also consultants, advisors, plan sponsors need to be educated as well in terms of what these offerings are and how they may be able to better position participants for the future. So hopefully these types of conversations can be had by fiduciaries around the country to think about these and other types of issues. And we thank you very much for joining us on the show. And we hope to have you back in the next couple months to check in on progress and hear a little bit more about direct real estate and how it can be used in retirement programs.
Great. Hey, thanks Jeff.
Invitation.
Appreciate the opportunity. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome back. That was the Defined Contribution Real Estate Council co-presidents Jennifer Perkins and Alan Swearingen. Now we're going to welcome in Investment News' Greg Iacocci. He's a reporter who covers the advisor, insurance, and retirement marketplace and a friend of the show's, Mr. Greg Iacocci. How you doing, buddy?
Good, good. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. We're having a great show today, and it is May the 4th today, and I don't know if you're a Star Wars fan, but May the 4th
I am
be with
indeed.
You.
I'm very familiar.
Are you dressed up? Are you dressed up?
May the 4th be with you, too.
You know, you kind of look like Han Solo.
That's quite the compliment.
High praise.
I didn't dress up today, but I don't think anyone's ever told me I look like Han Solo before, but I'll definitely take it.
Okay, well, that was my compliment. I'm going through training.
Greg, did you ever watch Deadwood, the HBO show Deadwood?
No, never. I haven't seen that one.
Never mind. I was going to let you know, but you probably heard that we just had Al Swearingen on the podcast, but that's falling on deaf ears for you and Jeff. So I'm going to go tell somebody about that later today. Anyway.
Nice.
So let's talk about some of the prevalent trends in 401k, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So some interesting stories lately. One that I wrote yesterday, which is sort of around some of the prevalent investing trends in 401k plans. For someone who covers the industry, I guess it wasn't all too surprising or new. These are trends that we've been talking about for the last couple of years, but I put some numbers behind some of the stuff we're seeing. Target date funds obviously continue to dominate the market in terms of adoption by 401k plans, putting them on their plan menus, but also in terms of participants just really funneling a ton of assets into these things. Perhaps not a surprise because it's the default option of choice in 401k plans. Some other things too, like a shift toward index funds and away from actively managed funds, a shift away from revenue sharing. I think that in large part has to do with some of these lawsuits that we've seen in 401k land. Revenue sharing, there are allegations that revenue sharing could lead to excessive fees if it goes unchecked. A lot of uptake in terms of offering Roth accounts to participants. The percentage has really, I think it's doubled over the past 10 years or so in terms of the number of plans that offer that to participants. So that's certainly a big trend too.
Yeah, Jeff, that's certainly something that you and I pay pretty close attention to, are things like the revenue sharing, and that goes down to the transparency, and mm-hmm. the industry's come such a long way. We have room to go still, but people being able to understand exactly how much everything costs, how much everybody's making, I think that's a really positive thing. So,
Yeah, we've great reporting by Greg. We've made progress. 2012 was the beginning of the fee disclosure rules. I think we've made some headway in terms of notifying participants, but you're right. There's still room to go and room to grow on that particular issue. And it's going to take some time. I mean, I think people are not really tuned in to the administrative costs and what it takes to run a retirement program. And then Greg makes another point about the indexing. I mean, there's definitely this litigation that continues to bubble up. And that's not to say that revenue sharing is bad. I think what the most important thing here is that people understand what the fees are for their retirement plan, whether they're a fiduciary or whether they're a participant, and they continue to evaluate those fees. You know, you don't just, you know, buy a service and just, you know, set it and forget it. You've got to make sure that you have the lowest share class possible for the plan, and that you know what your fees are. And as your plan grows in size, theoretically, you've got economies of scale. So I think there's a lot of room to grow, but we've made a lot of good progress as well.
And Greg, this can you tell me a little bit about, I know that you said it, but it went in one ear and not the other. Is it that people are putting more money into the Roth option inside a 401k as of late?
Well, it's more plans are offering it to participants, so they're making the option available along with, you know, the traditional pre-tax option. The research I did didn't look at that particular data point. If more participants were putting more of their money into Roth, but I think one sort of follows the other because it's a pretty substantial amount of plans that have added the option over the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's from my personal experience, it's a very, very popular option. So, and just sticking with Roth accounts in general, has your work shown that more people are interested in those accounts and building more assets inside of them?
Well, yeah, you know, the tax reform debate that happened at the end of last year really, I think, put a renewed focus on Roth. You know, people have been talking about Roth as a good tax diversification tool for quite some time. You know, having Roth IRA assets and 401k assets can really help manage your income taxes when you're in retirement. You know, so I think there's been a focus on that from a retirement advisor standpoint. But, you know, at the end of last year, people were talking about, is this whole Rothification thing going to happen? There was discussion in Congress, right, about putting like any money that you contribute above $2,400, I think it was, in a 401k plan. They were talking about putting that all into Roth accounts instead of pre-tax accounts. And that would have helped the federal government from a budgeting standpoint, making the math work with its, you know, its new federal tax plan. That didn't come to pass, of course. But I think there's definitely, you know, a lot of focus on Roth now, in part because of the tax reform debate.
Well, that certainly is a very interesting thing, and it certainly makes sense to me. And I don't know if that's good or bad necessarily that we're having intense conversations based on the government trying to balance its books. And I'm not saying that's up to where we're just talking about, but I think that I know for a fact that for so many Americans, if they're not paying any income taxes, that it could potentially be a good place for them. And when I say a good place, I mean that the Roth option inside of a retirement plan, because there's really not a lot of reason to put in pre-tax dollars if you're not actually paying any income tax in general. So, but anyway.
Hey, Greg, you mentioned, just as we have about a minute left in the segment, and I know you do a lot of conference travel. You know, I've seen you at NAGDA and Spark and other places. Any recent travel to any conferences that you might want to talk about real briefly? What was interesting there?
Sure. I think one big one I went to recently, about 2 weeks ago, was the National Association of Plan Advisors conference. NAPA is the organization. So they do it every year. It brought like 2,500 people, the bulk of them retirement plan advisors. That's always a good conference. I think one of the interesting things for me, one of the stories I wrote from that particular conference, what kind of plays into the tax reform thing I was just talking about. So the head of the organization, Brian Graff, he was sort of saying that while it's good that Congress didn't really change 401k plans in any material way as a result of tax reform, it showed Congress that Americans really care a lot about retirement. You know, there was a whole furor over taking away retirement benefits. And that could end up being potentially bad news for retirement plan advisors in the sense that so now Congress has their eyes on retirement plans. They see there's this huge coverage gap, like 50% roughly of American workers don't have access to a workplace retirement plan. So the federal government could try to step in, create like a federal framework, which could hurt advisors and the industry if they try to do like step in and do the investment management. They don't hand that over to the private sector. That's just one of the concerns that I heard, one of the big ones at the conference.
That's definitely something to keep an eye on. Well, Greg, thank you so much,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, I'll say. And, you know, well, hey, thanks for having me. I know I have my homework cut out. I got to watch Deadwood, and I have to go find a Jedi Knight outfit.
May the 4th be with you. Have a good Cinco de Mayo, Greg. And we'll have you back soon to you know, catch up on you know, the latest news that you're uncovering as you go about your job.
Thanks, Greg.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys, for having me.
Thanks. Take care. Well, that was Investment News' Greg Iacocci kind of sharing what was going on in the 401k world and retirement space. And now we are joined by the dynamic duo of the stock market and all things economic. We've got Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg and TD Ameritrade Network's Oliver Rennick. Guys, how are you this afternoon?
Doing great. It's Friday. Can't complain.
Happy Friday, gentlemen.
Happy Friday. So it's been a while, Oliver, since you and I have talked. But what's going on in the markets this week? Why don't you catch up the audience, what's transpired, and looks like some more whipsaw volatility going on.
Whipsaw, indeed, Mr. Snyder. Was glad to have you on the program this week. We have been watching basically earnings volatility and no real clear kind of direction for equities right now. It's a lot of selling around company earnings and then maybe buying the next day as investors get less worried about what's to come and more excited about the current state. But honestly, you know, I think what we're going through is a very clear repricing of valuations in the stock market, which is looking at the economy, finding out that it's supposedly in this different stage of growth, which is probably true, and figuring out how much you want to pay for companies. What I've been most keyed in on this week, actually, is the U.S. dollar. I think it has been telling a pretty interesting story. There has been a resurgent strength in the greenback, to many surprise. And I think it largely probably is tied to central bank activity, where our Fed from this week's minutes are pretty much on course to hike rates. And the rest of the world is kind of questioning their own situation. We've got some slowdown in data that's been going on for a while in Europe and Japan. And suddenly we emerge as kind of the hawk on the block. And dollar strengthens, but within them there might be sort of a bullish stocks case. It's really interesting. There's a lot that is certainly going on with earnings, but I think from this week we also can't, of course, discount the Fed and what might end up being kind of a dovish global central bank backdrop.
Yeah, no, and I'll piggyback on a lot of that. I mean, it's, as Oliver mentioned, you're trying to find a direction for the market right now. And guys, I mean, feel free to cut me off if this sounds repetitive, but to be honest, it's been, you know, kind of same old this week in terms of earnings news coming out better than expected. Earnings continue to accelerate for a number of different sectors. But a lot of companies are just their stocks are just getting beat up, you know, after market or after they disclose and they report earnings. So it is an interesting dynamic going on. I think a lot of it has to do with some of the points that Oliver brought up. The strengthening dollar is something that we're watching as well. You know, he mentioned central bank activity. I think one of the other things that people are watching for is the you know, difference in yields between the different regions and different countries. That's finally starting to come into play, which is typically how people measure where dollar forecasts could be in the future. So there's a number of different things at play. I mean, a strengthening dollar, what does that mean for stocks? Yes, it can be a bullish case. I'd say more so for the domestic smaller cap names that tie a lot more of their revenue and their business to the U.S. and not nearly as exposed to international currency fluctuations, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, it's been a great earnings season. We talked about it last week, how it's a discounted, the market's a discounting mechanism, and we still haven't seen upward revisions, you know, with earnings estimates, analysts coming out and pushing those higher for the next year or 2 years now. So it's a little difficult until we see, you know, analysts get more bullish on what's to come after, you know, this year and after we get all the effects, the trickle-down effects of tax cuts. Unless we see, you know, those longer forecasts get raised higher, I don't know what the catalyst could be for a big move higher in the market.
In what could be called or considered the Trump effect on CEOs, Elon Musk called an analyst's questions boring and referred to him as a bonehead recently. How does something like that affect an actual stock's valuation, do you think, or does it?
It can affect it a number of different ways. I mean, you saw, from a valuation standpoint, you saw Tesla kind of get hacked after that, right? There, from a stock price perspective, which if you're somebody who's been watching Tesla, has been looking for a good point to buy in and looking for the opportunity to get in, and you're still, you know, long on the stock, or you believe that it's still, the growth prospects are still there, then that was, you know, created an opportunity. Elon's comments kind of created an opportunity. A stock like Tesla is kind of a little bit of an anomaly in terms of how much I think the market has bought into the vision of the leader, right? Without Elon Musk, I mean, what really is Tesla, or what would people be paying for? But those types of comments, I mean, your job as a corporate executive, and maybe I'm a little bit biased because, you know, we sit on that side of things where we're always trying to get more more intel from the C-suite as to what's going on with the company. But, you know, I think you kind of got to treat those people and those analysts, you know, obviously with not only just respect, but, you know, they're taking the time to try and look into, you know, what your company's doing so they can convey an opinion to the market. And I think sometimes, and especially with this case with Tesla, that can get a little misconstrued. So certainly comments like that will introduce some volatility. But again, if you're somebody who's been looking at Tesla and it's been on your watch list, then maybe this week, you know, is a good time to get into it.
All agreed in terms of sort of the relationships between CEOs and the street. But I would just add from a sort of investing and trading perspective, it's pretty interesting. I can't think of another time in which a CEO has so clearly essentially set himself up for such a distinct and measurable performance and bar. He has now basically said that anyone questioning the viability of their business model is basically a fool and doesn't understand it, very dismissive about it. He said that there will be free cash flow positive by the end of the year. So for me, I don't see how if you're a Tesla shareholder, you don't hold him to those standards at the end of the year. It's a pretty clear sort of timeline he's set up. And if he doesn't reach it, then he looks like a pretty bad manager of a business. Doesn't mean he's not a brilliant visionary, but I think that's essentially what also might have come into account with that type of volatility. Stock has come back a little bit today, but I mean, this is very much one of those companies that we look for from kind of a sentiment gauge, if you will. I think we talked about this before, but if you just think about sort of the spectrum for risk and the amount of clarity on use cases for things and why you invest in things, I mean, there's basically the crypto market on the very end, which is a excitement about something that could be disruptive very, you know, in the future, and you essentially make a bet on that without a lot of fundamental use. Tesla is somewhere closer to your average company, but it is that idea where you are essentially betting on something that's supposed to happen down the future, and there's not a lot to show for it right now. So when you see volatility in it, especially when there's volatility in even more reliable and money-making businesses in the market, it's not that big of a surprise to me that we're seeing big swings in the stock. And then you mix in the idea that he's set himself up for some high standards, and really Elon Musk is why this stock trades at $300 and not anywhere else. So if his role comes under question 2 quarters, who knows what happens to the company. That's all I would say on that.
If I could just toss in one more quick thing just on valuation, because I think it's, you know, make a number of good points, but it's something that we should stress is when you look at a company from a valuation, let's call it a price to earnings basis, right? So how much money is a company making versus what you're paying for it? You know, a lot of these growthy type names, as Oliver was alluding to, will trade up at higher, what we call higher premiums or higher multiples, so that you would expect them to have a higher PE ratio because people are paying for what potentially could be with this stock, a big growth name. And it is kind of almost like a big bet on the company and the vision rather than a what we would consider a stable company, you know, like a Procter & Gamble, which you know what their business model is, consistent cash flow and things of that nature. So it's just important when you compare company to company or even, you know, sector to sector, what the growth rates are and the expected growth rates are for those companies.
I might add that a lot of people would rather own Tesla than Procter & Gamble right now. But
couldn't agree more unless you're a dividend yield guy.
I just hope it doesn't come out that he was just hangry. You know, somebody could have given him a Snickers bar and this could have been totally avoided.
If that meme hasn't already started, it should be.
Maybe he's got an endorsement deal ahead of him if things don't work out.
You know what? That's a good point, Kevin. That is an awesome meme just waiting to happen. So
yeah, that might be what the rest of my Friday looks like.
Yeah, it's just a you know, it's just a shame that there's like this coarsening. So we have the coarsening in our politics, and now we're having the coarsening in our businesses. It's just, it's really, you know, the markets are based on collaboration. So I don't want to sound all, you know, ideological.
No, that's a good point.
But I think it, you know, it's we have to get along, and we have to have a sharing of ideas, and you know, rather than just going the, you know, yelling at each other, it really doesn't seem to work too well.
Totally.
Real quickly. We had, positive earnings numbers for Apple, but then Snap went the other direction. We were talking with our tech reporter, Natalie Walters, on that earlier in the show. I mean, how are you guys kind of looking at the tech sector right now? What are you thinking about when you see some of these numbers come out from Snap, Apple, the Facebook privacy issue? You know, FANG stocks make up a huge part of our earnings or our growth. How's this all kind of compute to you?
I can set kind of the big broad stage, and I'll let Ollie go into the individual names. I mean, the tech sector in general it's one of those growth machines like we've been talking about, you know, this whole segment. And that has continued this quarter. What is interesting, though, is when you look at tech and the current earnings stream compared to the rest of the market, yes, to your point, you know, the Apples of the world are massive when it comes to corporate earnings, the share of corporate earnings that they make up. But the growth rate and the expected growth rates are kind of going to start to slow down a bit as we head into later this year and really into 2019. And it might come more in line with, you know, the rest of the broader market, which, again, tech's been one of the best performing, you know, sectors for this entire cycle. And so what I think you'll see is as earnings expectations kind of come down a little bit or ease, people might not be willing to pay up as much for some of those companies. Not to say that Apple didn't have a great quarter, and that's one of the big reasons why the tech sector for the S&P 500 is even, you know, green on the week, because they are such a major portion of it. But it is something, again, you want to keep in mind, you know, how fast can they grow and how sustainable is that growth as we kind of move forward.
Excellent stuff, gentlemen. You guys have an excellent... May the 4th be with you, and try to keep it clean this weekend on Cinco de Mayo.
You got it, guys.
You got it. Take it easy, guys.
Well, Jeff, there it is. Another great episode in the books, man.
I'm sorry. I was putting on my Han Solo outfit. I thought it was a great episode. Lots of good stuff to cover this week. I mean, we heard from one of the leading 401k publications, Greg Iacocci, or at least the reporter for one of the leading 401k publications, Greg Iacocci, went into direct real estate as well, hearing from Jennifer and Alan from the Defined Contribution Real Estate Council. And then, of course, our all-stars. I mean, they are just phenomenal. Natalie, Allie, Jacob, Oliver, David, Kevin, and Kevin. I mean, just a wonderful job. Kind of keeping us up to date. I mean, really making this podcast, this show, the one-stop shop for all the retirement news that matters. And George, you know, I don't know how we top it, but I think we're going to try to top it again next week.
We can just do the best we can, brother.
That's what we're going to do. So you have a great week. Enjoy Cinco de Mayo, and look forward to catching up with you during the week on our next show.
Sounds good, man. Have a good one.
May the 4th be with you.